Now I can understand why you were hot, 'cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame, tried to tell us it was all the same. But now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. And those WMD you promised on TV, hey, admit it, you figured it wrong. So I'm taking my country back.
Greetings, this is podcast number 10 of Blast the Right. I'm Jack Clark of therationalradical.com, www.therationalradical.com. First off today, we're going to discuss, is it necessary to kick right-wingers off of lifeboat Earth? Then we'll discuss a piece of legislation that can make it awful difficult for right-wingers to continue to pass laws that kill and harm people. Then we'll go on to listen to Bill O'Reilly expound further on his theories of why there is poverty in the United States. And then we'll wrap it up with a little bit more, continuing from last week, of my right-wing pseudo-Christians challenge. Challenge to right-wing pseudo-Christians. Let's get right into the first segment. Forbes magazine reported earlier this year that there are 691 billionaires in the world, 691 billionaires, and their total wealth is $2.2 trillion. Now, a trillion is 1,000 billion, so $2.2 trillion means these 691 guys own $2,200 billion worth of assets. Wouldn't it be great if there could be a 10% you just can't hog that much of the Earth's resources tax imposed on them? That would raise $220 billion. Now, the United Nations has estimated that poverty in the world could be wiped out for $150 billion. So the $220 billion is actually more than we need. Maybe we could be less harsh on our billionaire brethren and cut the tax to 7%. That would raise about $150 billion. We certainly wouldn't want to unnecessarily cause these billionaires to give up any part of the lifestyle to which they become accustomed, would we? Hey, wait a minute! I hear the right-wing hordes shouting. Those 691 billionaire heroes earn their money honestly and have every right to keep every red cent of it. The rest of humanity be damned. Well, not the way I look at it. In so many ways, Earth is a lifeboat we've all been placed on. Imagine on a real lifeboat that there's 10 people. One of them nominally owns most of the provisions aboard the ship. He insists that he'll eat as much as he wants and doesn't have to share any of it with anybody else. How long do you think it will be before the only relationship with food that this guy has is as a tasty meal for a shark? There's not infinite wealth on Earth. If some passengers on the lifeboat have so much that others are without, the overprovisioned ones just have to give some of theirs up. Aside to right-wingers who may be listening, I understand that there's no mechanism to collect the tax I've spoken about, the you just can't hog that much of the Earth's resources tax. Just understand that I'm presenting these numbers to point out the immoral concentration of the Earth's wealth in the hands of a tiny number of people. You know, when you think about it, this whole concept of private property is an artificial construct of man's imagination. Everything was here when you were born. Unless you have a certificate of title from the Creator, no one really can own anything other than by the agreement of everyone else that such ownership is valid. And most of the time, that's fine. I am all for private property. Please don't write to me and say, oh, you're against private property. No. I like private property. I have some stuff that I really like that I own. I want to keep it. I don't want anyone to take it. But right now, we do exclude certain things from being owned. humanity wouldn't tolerate it if someone came along and claimed to own the oxygen in the air. Certain land, such as Antarctica, has been put off limits. I say ridiculous levels of wealth accumulation by individuals should likewise be considered outside the pale, something that simply cannot be tolerated if the majority of mankind has anything to say about it. Unfortunately, the majority of humanity has never had any say about it. Unlike what right-wingers and the powers that be would like us all to obediently believe, the 691 billionaires, not to mention the Western First World nations over the centuries of first formal colonialism and then the successor World Bank IMF regime, they didn't acquire their lewdly disproportionate share of the Earth's resources honestly. Might makes right is more like it. An aphorism is defined as a concise statement of a principle or a terse formulation of a truth or sentiment. Just about my favorite aphorism in the world is contained in some words I heard from a woman in the third world when I was on a what they call a reality tour there. And she was speaking to our tour group about how things looked to her. What she said was, God gave the earth to everyone equally, and if some have too much and some too little, the ones with too much must have stolen it some way. Let me repeat that. God gave the earth to everyone equally, and if some have too much and some too little, the ones with too much must have stolen it some way. Let's just break down the three parts of this statement. The first part is God gave the earth to everyone equally. Whether you believe in God or not, or what God you believe in, could it really be denied that every human being has the right to a fair share of the earth's resources, at least enough to keep them alive, if they fulfill their part of the bargain and work hard and play by the rules? The second part is, if some have too much and some too little. I don't think anyone could really argue that some on the earth have too much and too many hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, have too little. Barely enough to survive, and in many cases, not enough to survive. That's why 11 million children every year under the age of 5 on planet Earth die needlessly from preventable hunger and preventable disease. The third part, the ones with too much must have stolen it some way. Well, the way I look at it, nobody is going to willingly give up the food that could keep them alive or the medicine that would let them recover from a sickness if they don't have it and they don't have the resources to get it. And if on the planet there's plenty of food and plenty of medicine for everybody, and even within every country there's plenty of food and plenty of medicine for everybody, then the ones with too much must have stolen it in some way. I would conclude that it's long past time for all stolen property to be returned to the rightful owners. And if they won't agree, then these demonically greedy right-wing bastards, we have to kick them out of our lifeboat. Let's now go on to the next topic. Sometimes I find an article that's a perfect expression of my own sensibilities. When I read the article, my thought is, I wish I had written that. Some of you will recall that I read such a piece a few podcasts ago. That was about the fantasy news broadcast from the year 2012, I think it was, where it described the arrest of retired President George Bush in Mexico for war crimes and his rendition to The Hague to stand trial. I found another article that similarly strikes a chord in me, and I want to share it with you. It was written by Lisa Martinovic. It's on commondreams.org. You could find it there by searching in their little search box for the term zero tolerance for pain, and her article will pop up. Before I read directly from the article, a bit of background. There's been a bill introduced in the Senate, S-51, the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act. One of its findings is, quote, "There is a valid federal government interest in reducing the number of events in which great pain is inflicted on sentient creatures," close quote. For right-wingers listening, the word sentient, S-E-N-T-I-E-N-T, means capable of feeling, conscious, aware. Now I'll read from the article. If passed, S-51 would mandate that women seeking an abortion at 20 weeks pregnant and beyond be, quote, "fully informed regarding the pain experienced by their unborn child," close quote, via a statement they must sign after it's read to them by their doctors. One wonders if Senator Brownback, who's one of the sponsors of the bill, has considered that the government's interest in mitigating suffering is categorical, equally relevant to everyone from America's torture victims to those enduring the calamitous aftermath of Katrina. And so, Mr. Senator, whose pain is worth alleviating or avoiding altogether? And by the way, I'm going to skip certain paragraphs, so I'm not reading the whole article. To go on with the what she wrote, fundamental tenets of justice dictate that the more pain your actions cause, the higher the standard to which you ought be held. But the federal government is not an equal opportunity pain reducer. And it's this selective sensitivity that demands our attention. By way of redress, I offer the Already Born Sentient Creatures Pain Awareness Act. The Already Born Sentient Creatures Pain Awareness Act. The act applies to decisions made by all those in positions of great power. Politicians, generals, Supreme Court justices, CEOs, etc. Legislators, for example, will be made to research, catalog, and include in every proposed bill evidence of pain likely to be experienced by sentient creatures subject to the legislation, be they minimum wage workers unable to afford a remotely decent life, inner city asthma victims of industrial pollution, disabled veterans, or endangered species. Each congressperson's spiritual advisor will read to them a statement enumerating the varieties and extent of pain they've chosen to mete out via the proposed legislation. Each will be made to sign the statement in ceremonies to take place on national television, where all Americans can bear witness to what is being authorized by our representatives in our name with our money. Public recognition of the odious consequences of our choices is as crucial for policymakers as it is for the citizenry. It means that we could never again take refuge in the delusion of unintended consequences, for we will have signed off on them in advance. Okay, if that's all she wrote, I think that would have been great. But she goes on to add yet another level of deliciousness. She goes on to write, "If there is no discernible shift towards sane, empathic public policy, then the I feel your pain provision of the Pain Awareness Act will take effect. Sample applications include the Secretary of Defense and Attorney General will be made to pose naked in uncomfortable positions, each with a sack over his head, in a freezing room, while considering if such treatment constitutes torture or mere abuse, and whether or not the Geneva Conventions are obsolete. The Navy strategists who deploy low-frequency sonar devices in the ocean will be placed underwater in the Marine World Dolphin Tank and blasted with the excruciating sounds that assault and kill sentient creatures whose hearing is far more acute than our own. All upper echelon military personnel will devote 2 weeks a year to hands-on humanitarian service in war zone orphanages, hospitals, or refugee camps. The CEO of Walmart will likewise do time as a checker in one of his super centers. Incognito, of course. And the next time the president is on the verge of slashing funds for essential infrastructure, environmental restoration, jobs creation, or public transportation, the next time he starts planning a war that will divide the nation, kill and maim thousands of our youth, undermine our economy, and overextend the National Guard, he will be sent to the Reflection Center. Located in a sweltering swamp, the center will accommodate the president in waist-deep, corpse-strewn sewage. He will be denied food and water for several days while standing in front of a well-stocked convenience store, a zero-tolerance MP behind him, M16 at the ready. Somewhere in Washington, someone will be babbling, "Don't worry, help is on the way." Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing this article. I sure enjoyed it when I read it. Okay, let's go on to the next subject. You may recall that a podcast or two ago, we heard from the inimitable Bill O'Reilly about why the people were on the roofs in New Orleans after Katrina.
Every American kid should be required to watch videotape of the poor in New Orleans and see how they suffered because they couldn't get out of town. And then every teacher should tell the students, if you refuse to learn, if you refuse to work hard, if you become addicted, if you live a gangsta life, you will be poor and powerless just like many of those in New Orleans.
Well, the other day, Bill gave us some more pearls of wisdom in the form of browbeating, berating, and yelling at Congressman Charlie Rangel. First, O'Reilly told us how we're already doing more than enough for the poor.
So the statistics say that you, Congressman Rangel, are wrong, that there is more spending, more money. Now, what else do you want? Do you want Bush to go to their house? I mean, what do you want him to do? He's spending an enormous, the country, me, you, everybody, spending an enormous amount of money to try to help people out of poverty, yet you're saying we don't care and he's Bull Connor. It doesn't add up, sir.
Then O'Reilly goes on to pull out two of the dirty tricks that right-wingers always use when discussing poverty. First, blaming the poor for their own plight, and second, bringing out the old socialism bugaboo. Listen.
What do you... There's always... No, there's no indictment against anybody. There are always going to be poor people, always, because they cannot control their own lives for one reason or another.
Well, that's my point.
You're spending $368 billion a year on 38 million poor people. What more do you want? Do you want a socialist society? Is that what you want? Where everybody has the same? Is that what you're gunning for?
That's right. They can't control themselves, and there's no alternative between 35 million Americans in poverty, nearly one out of eight Americans. There's no alternative between that and socialism. You may think that O'Reilly has already stuck his foot in his mouth as far as it'll go, but he's just getting warmed up. Listen to him expand his thesis about the faults of the poor.
But how much more money do you want? You have plenty of money to accomplish that. Some people will not become educated, will become addicted.
The whole issue. You are missing the whole issue.
No, I'm not. I've got this. I've got the money that is spent on poverty entitlements right in front of me. It is more than enough to raise everybody out of poverty. Some people choose not to compete in a capitalist society. That's the truth.
Wow, they won't become educated, they'll become addicted, and they will choose not to compete in a capitalist society. That's obviously the answer. Finally, O'Reilly, considering himself, I guess, something of a comedian, picks up and ends with his "what do you want Bush to do" little shtick from earlier.
Well, what is the answer? Do you want Bush to go to their house and tutor them? Do you want him to give them birth control?
Yes, I think Bush, that master of the English language, should certainly be the one to go tutor the poor. And of course, there are just too many of them. They're breeding like rabbits, so we got to give them birth control. Yes, I would nominate George Bush to go to the houses of every poor person and personally put on the condom on each male of the household. Since there are 35 million people living in poverty in this country, that's just about 1 in 8 Americans. Did you know that when you walk down the street, 1 in 8 people you see are addicted? They're people who refuse to become educated. They're people who choose not to compete in a capitalist society. Is that what you see when you walk down the street? That's what Bill O'Reilly sees. Didn't the French invent the guillotine for people with views like Bill O'Reilly? And I'll tell you what the scariest thing of all is. There are so many people who listen to O'Reilly and believe him. I get emails from people where they just take what he said and regurgitate it back to me verbatim in the email, word for word often. My favorite O'Reilly talking point that people send in to me like it was the gospel is O'Reilly's dishonest use of statistics to compare the poverty rates under George Bush and Bill Clinton. Everyone knows that every year under George Bush, the number of Americans in poverty and the poverty rate itself as a percentage of the population have both increased. Yet what O'Reilly does, he says, well, in the midpoint of the Clinton presidency, the poverty rate was 13.7%, and in the midpoint of the Bush presidency, the poverty rate was 12.7%. Now, how imbecilic is that? We're not comparing the halftime scores of two football games where at the beginning of each game, each team starts at 0-0. There the comparison might make some sense. Clinton didn't start at 0 and Bush didn't start at 0. In fact, Bush started with what Clinton left him. Clinton left him an 11.3% poverty rate. So Bush started at 11.3%. And in the middle of Bush's presidency, it's up to 12.7. Every year of Bush's presidency, it's increased. Even if you want to take O'Reilly's comparison and use it midterm to midterm, the fact is, by the middle of Clinton's term, he had reduced the poverty rate from what it was when he started the presidency. The poverty rate that he inherited, he had reduced. Bush is the exact opposite. In the middle of Bush's term, he's increased the poverty rate from what he inherited. So either way, Bill O'Reilly's flim-flam bamboozleman snake oil salesman statistics don't hold up. Bill O'Reilly's blame the poor approach to the issue of poverty leads nicely into the final segment today, which is about fake phony Christians, fake phony right-wing Christians. I call them right-wing pseudo-Christians. P-S-E-U-D-O, pseudo, means fake and phony, right-wing pseudo-Christians. Last week, I laid out how to effectively challenge right-wing Christians. The challenge is based on Matthew 25's parable of the sheep and goats, where Jesus says, as you treat the least of these is how you treat him. Jesus tells one group of people that they're going to heaven because when Jesus was hungry, they fed him, thirsty, they gave him drink, when he was sick, they ministered to him, etc. And when they asked, when did they do these things for him? Jesus said, as you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. The other group of people, Jesus tells, you're going to hell because when I was hungry, you did not feed me, thirsty, and you did not give me drink. Sick, and you did not minister to me. When they asked, Lord, when did we not feed thee, or give thee drink, or minister to thee? Jesus said, as you did it not to the least of these, my brethren, you did it not to me. So the challenge to right-wing Christians is, propose to them some measure, some program, some way that will help a group of the least of these. And when the right-wing Christian opposes your plan, which they invariably will do, you say to them, what's your equivalent alternative solution? What is your plan that will help the same number of people, the same amount, as soon and as certainly? And if they don't have such a plan, then you tell them that they are doing exactly what Jesus condemned in Matthew 25 and sent the people to hell for, which is refusing to help the least of these. Now, that's a very shorthand summary of what I went over last week. At the end of last podcast, I said that right-wingers have many, many objections they raise to this challenge, and I was going to go over them week by week. I've identified about 16 specific counterarguments that they come up with to try to counter your equivalent alternative solutions challenge to them. Today, there's not a lot of time left, so I'm going to give a very broad overview of right-winger objections. Right-wing objections to our equivalent alternative solutions challenge fall into three main categories. The first objection area is they give a very narrow reading to Matthew 25 and say it doesn't apply to whatever you're talking about, or that your interpretation is inconsistent with the rest of the Bible or is taken out of context. Your simple reply to that? Your interpretation is consistent with scores of other biblical passages, and indeed your interpretation and analysis of Matthew 25 is the exact same one that is the official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. Even if the person isn't Catholic, surely the official doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church bears some weight and cannot be dismissed as the out-of-context, ignorant ravings of a left-winger. They have to come up with a better objection than that. The second main area of objection of right-wingers to the equivalent alternative solutions challenge is they start either criticizing the details of your plan or just go into an anti-government rant. The simple answer to that? Say, fine, my program isn't perfect. Yes, the government has problems when it institutes reforms, but certainly my plan is going to be a lot better than nothing. It's going to still help a lot of people, a lot of the least of these. What is your equivalent alternative solution that will help at least the same amount of people, the same amount, as soon and as certainly? You just repeat the equivalent alternative solutions challenge. Criticizing your plan is not a valid objection. They have to come up with a better one themselves. Don't let them get away with saying, "Oh, I think private charities will be able to help all these people." Or their great alternative fake solution, "Well, the free market will take care of this problem, I'm sure." No. It has to be a real plan. A real plan that has goals and timetables and is certain to be accomplished. The final area of right-winger objections to our equivalent alternative solutions challenge to them is one that you just heard Bill O'Reilly give. Blame the poor. It's their own fault that they're poor. Well, you can go into detail and show that that's not true, and show how that's not the proper approach to the problem in the Bible. However, the simplest thing to do is to say, okay, my plan will just help children who have this problem. The least of these will just limit to children. Certainly then, you cannot blame children for the problems of their parents. You cannot blame the children for being poor. There you have it. Those are some of the objections that right-wingers raise, and I've given some of the quick answers you can give to them. We'll get into this in more detail in the weeks to come. Well, that'll about wrap it up for today. If you enjoyed what you heard, I have an entire website full of great material for you to check out, www.therationalradical.com. And if you enjoyed what you heard, please also tell your friends. Turn them on to podcasting if they don't know about it. And, as always, send your comments about Blast the Right to Rational@Adelphia.net. Rational@Adelphia.net. Let me mention that the music I open the podcast with and that I'll close with today is called Taking My Country Back. It's by Honky Tonkers for Truth out of Nashville. Until next time, I'll sign off and say I love you all, including all you right-wing pieces of crap.
Now you don't